Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, we hear the warnings every year. Be mosquito aware, even during years of drought here in California. Around this time, we're reminded to start draining standing water, use insect repellent to fight the bite. And although we'll get notifications about West Nile, whether found in a dead bird or even a human case, we might not pay all that much attention. However, this year may be very well a different story. This week, you'll likely start to hear more public service announcements as the Sacramento Yellow Vector Control District is launching its annual awareness campaign to remind everyone about the dangers that mosquitoes can carry and what everyone can do to help lower the potential of activity around the places they live. Joining us now is Luz Robles, the agency's public information officer. Good morning, Luz.
Good morning. Thank you for having me today.
We have had this conversation, you and I, for many years, Luz, and you've been with the Sacramento YOLO Mosquito and Vector Control District for quite some time. But I'm just curious, when you like step outside of when you're 9 to 5, when you get outside of work, you tell people what you do for a living. What are the most common questions that you get?
Well, this year, the most common question that I'm getting is it going to be a bad mosquito season this year because of all this rain that we've had? So that's been the top question. We were actually at an event last weekend, and that was, if I could have counted how many times I got asked that question, I would have lots of money. I should have asked people for a dollar.
Yeah, it would be lots of like coffee trips for me going to coffee shops with those dollars. So when it comes to that answer, what is the answer?
Well, you know what? The answer is definitely it's going to be a very busy mosquito season just because we've had record amounts of rain this year. Every year, usually we have a lull in the rain sometime in February and then followed by a warm spell. But it seems like this year it never really stopped raining until now, right? So all this record amount of rain has definitely left behind a lot of stagnant water. And it's definitely something that we're concerned about, right? So it's still a little bit too early to tell what kind of mosquito season it's going to be. But based on the amount of rainfall, it is likely going to be a busy season because there are lots of areas that do have stagnant water, right? Not only our common household sources, but just in general, roadside ditches, pastures, a lot of areas that could potentially become mosquito breeding sources and create a busy season for us ahead.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned it's still too early to tell, but we did have relentless atmospheric rivers. We have record snowpacks in some portions of the Sierra, or if not near record snowpacks as well. And you've been with Vector Control in Sacramento and Yolo counties for years. Does this year remind you of years past? Is there a comparison?
You know what? Oh, we have a laboratory that tracks all of the mosquito trends and the abundance. And there have been other years that have, you know, that have seen lots of rain and obviously mosquito populations. As of now, mosquito populations are on track with what we have seen in previous years. And I know that a lot of people think that a lot of rain could definitely make for a lot of mosquitoes. And for sure it can. But it's also important to understand that just because there's a lot of mosquitoes doesn't necessarily mean that we might have intense virus activity. So in years past, when we've been in the drought, we have seen intense levels of West Nile virus activity, even though there's a drought. So this year, yes, we might likely see lots of mosquitoes because of the rain and all the stagnant water. But in terms of virus activity, obviously in intense mosquito populations could lead to intense virus activity as well. But as of now, it's still a little bit too early to tell. Our laboratory surveillance activities will start at the beginning of May. That's when we will start tracking West Nile virus activity in bird populations. And then that's really when the season will really kind of come to a start.
So it could even be during drought years as well. And obviously, when tracking viruses, that is the priority for your agency. What are the conditions historically that lead to more virus activity among mosquitoes from one year to the next?
So, for instance, as you just mentioned, drought, right? So when we did have the drought, we did have a limited amount of water. So basically, after there was some evaluation, they figured out that because there was limited amounts of water, that basically birds and mosquitoes would congregate together at these limited water sources. And that created more virus transmission between bird populations and mosquito populations. So, you know, that's something that we definitely, you know, we're keeping an eye on. This year, because there's so much water, we're really more concerned about just the amount of mosquito breeding sources. And I know that a lot of times people think of, you know, the very large sources that we mentioned, the pastures, the ag areas, but we really want people to pay attention to even those small sources around people's homes, because we know where the creeks are, the rivers, the pastures, the ag areas, but we can't be in everybody's backyard. So we really depend on people to help us and having them do their part in, you know, dumping out that stagnant water that can produce mosquitoes.
What are some good examples of there being too much standing water in someone's backyard that maybe it might get overlooked by someone? They don't think it's that much.
Yes. So, I mean, even a small amount of water, say in a bucket, a plant saucer, a bird bath, a kiddie pool, you know, a dog dish, even that small amount is enough to produce mosquitoes. We actually have invasive mosquitoes that have started spreading throughout our area. And those mosquitoes only need about a teaspoon of water in order to begin their life cycle. So laying their eggs and having that life cycle start. So, you know, we ask that people at least once a week, please do their part, look around their yard and dump out any stagnant water, and also even scrub down those containers, because some of those, especially these invasive mosquitoes, they can lay eggs along the sides of containers. So, you know, scrubbing down containers also goes a long way in helping us reduce mosquito populations.
Okay, so how are invasive mosquitoes different from native mosquitoes?
So invasive mosquitoes, so we have two species of invasive mosquitoes. So Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus, these are two mosquitoes that have been in California now since 2011. But in our region, we discovered them for the first time in 2019, and they've been slowly spreading to different areas. So what makes these mosquitoes different is that, one, they're aggressive day biting mosquitoes. Our traditional native mosquitoes bite typically at dawn and dusk. These can bite aggressively all day long. They really prefer to bite people. And then also, these mosquitoes can transmit new diseases such as Zika, dengue, and chikungunya, diseases that, you know, are very common in other parts of the world and not necessarily here in California. We have not had any locally transmitted diseases here, but we do see those diseases imported from other countries every year. And obviously, if these mosquitoes are here, then that increases the possibility that we could also see those diseases, you know, locally.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, you know, just a few potentially harmful diseases, you know, but I think the main one, at least that we're familiar with, that y'all track is West Nile. And last year, according to your agency, there were over 200 cases of West Nile and 13 deaths attributed to the West Nile virus, and that was statewide. So can you explain just what is West Nile and how it's transmitted, and even if can pets also get West Nile as well?
Yes, so you're correct. So are the, you know, the disease that we track and the one that we're most concerned about is West Nile virus activity. It's a disease transmitted between birds and mosquitoes. So birds such as crows, jays, magpies, those are the ones that are more susceptible to West Nile virus. Of course, you know, an infected mosquito can also bite a horse. It can also bite a person. And, you know, we're very concerned about this disease because it's one that's here to stay. It's endemic to our area. And it's not going anywhere. So every year we do see cases of West Nile virus. The numbers that you provided were for California. But we had 5 cases in Sacramento County, 3 cases in Yolo County. So it's definitely something that we're very concerned about. You know, 80% of people don't develop any West Nile virus symptoms. However, 20% of people develop the classic headache, fever, body aches, fatigue, vomiting. And then 1 in 150 people develop the very severe form of the disease that leads to meningitis or encephalitis, which can, you know, those are the cases that are very severe and can lead to death, unfortunately.
Yeah. Back in 2016, I interviewed a Winters woman who had survived West Nile virus. And it was a severe case. And so it can certainly be serious. On the onset, when you have these symptoms, can it be mistaken for like maybe having the cold or flu or even COVID?
Yes, unfortunately, because these symptoms are very common to a variety of, you know, of ailments. It's something that, you know, people can definitely confuse it with, you know, either flu or COVID. But, you know, that's why we recommend that, if, especially if you start to develop these symptoms after, say, going camping or spending lots of time outside, that you definitely visit your healthcare provider. They would take a blood sample, and that's how it would be diagnosed. You know, there's really no treatment for it, but it's definitely something that we are interested in tracking, and we want to know if somebody is having, if somebody's diagnosed with West Nile.
Yeah. And given that you're going to start conducting surveillance in May, is there a peak season for mosquitoes in our area?
I mean, mosquitoes, we see mosquitoes year round, but the peak time when we see the most is probably, you know, June, July, August, September. Those are the times when we see our traditional mosquitoes, and actually invasive mosquitoes, we see a lot more peak later in the fall. So in our area, we have about 24 different species of mosquitoes that we see at different times of the year. But the ones that can transmit West Nile virus are more active in the summer. So that June, July, August, that's when we see the cases or the populations really start to build up. And then the West Nile virus cases, as far as invasive mosquitoes, we see them later in the fall, anywhere from, say, September, even through November. So we really, until we start to see temperatures decline, that's when most mosquito populations really, really start to go down.
Yeah, and we're really honing in on, like, standing water. But are there actually, like, good insects that you want to keep around your house that actually eat mosquitoes?
Yes. So, you know, some of our friends would definitely be, say, dragonflies. You know, think about crane flies. People usually think of crane flies as a big giant mosquito, and they're not. They don't eat mosquitoes. It's a totally different insect. So, you know, it actually has the same life cycle, but it doesn't feed on mosquitoes. But so dragonflies, moths, birds, frogs, those are bats. They definitely feed on a lot of mosquitoes. And people usually ask me, are mosquitoes good for anything? And well, they're definitely part of the food chain.
Yeah. And then you also have fish as well, right? That they help eat mosquitoes too.
Exactly. So mosquito fish, yeah, they're one of our it's one of our biological control methods. So we have mosquito fish here at our district. If you have a pond, a fountain, a horse trough and need a mosquito fish, please give us a call, fill out a service request. We're happy to bring them to you. We also put those fish in different areas such as rice fields, agricultural areas, you know, pastures, dairy sums, because they're very effective at helping us reduce mosquito populations overall.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Luz Robles with the Sacramento Yellow Vector Control District about the concern over this year's mosquito population. Okay, Luz, I have the million-dollar question. Why do mosquitoes like some people more than others?
Maybe because people are really sweet. So, no, I'm just joking. Mosquitoes are attracted to people based on our scent. You know, just our, you know, there's some people that are naturally more attractive to mosquitoes, but we're always attracting mosquitoes because they're attracted to our breath, right? So the CO2 in our breath attracts mosquitoes, and just our overall scent. So maybe if you're out jogging and you're a little bit sweaty, that would attract mosquitoes. Maybe you're wearing a fruity lotion and fruity shampoo, but, basically overall scent, you know, our overall body chemistry, all of that, you know, makes it so that you're more attractive to mosquitoes or not. So that's why we always recommend that you always wear an effective mosquito repellent if you're going to be spending time outside, and just because we want to make sure that you're staying protected against any mosquito bites.
When it comes to repellent, what should people be aware of? Because, I mean, you look at shelves and shelves, there's a lot to choose from. It can be overwhelming.
Yes, it can be. So basically, please determine your activity, right? So if you're going to be camping or hiking in an area where there's lots of mosquitoes, look for a repellent that has a higher percentage of that active ingredient. So active ingredients that are common are DEET or picaridin. So most repellents have anywhere from like a 7 to 30% amount of DEET or picaridin. So if you're going to be outside or camping, hiking, look for, say, a 30% DEET that's going to give you longer protection. So 4 to 6 hours. If you're just going to be walking the dog, going out for a short walk, something that has 7 to 15 is going to be more than enough, because that will give you about 1 to 2 hours worth of protection.
And there are some that say like DEET free or they're natural. Do natural ones work as well?
There's oil of lemon eucalyptus, which is actually a good natural alternative option for those that don't want to do DEET or picaridin. But yeah, there's a variety of, you know, different options, but oil of lemon eucalyptus is probably your best one for a natural one.
Hmm. And what about those candles people use outside? You know, if you're barbecuing or whatever, do those actually work?
I mean, people usually often use citronella candles. They don't really work as well. We always recommend, you know, personal protection. So something that you actually put on your skin, but they're better than nothing. And then, you know, the closer you are to the candle, the more effective it'll be. But personal protection with repellent is best. Mm.
When it comes to our area, it's such a large area. It's also geographically, it's diverse. You have a valley, but you also have the foothill areas. I remember in previous interviews with you, mosquitoes can actually be in snow, which I was not aware of. So are there certain areas in the greater Sacramento region that are more prone to mosquito activity than others?
Well, definitely. I mean, any area that has water. So within our two counties, we have lots of agricultural areas, lots of rice. You know, that's always wet because that, you know, that's what you need to be able to grow rice. So those areas are definitely more prone to mosquitoes. So that's one, you know, rice fields, ag areas, pastures, dairy, sumps, all of those are areas that we closely monitor for mosquito activity. Mm.
Finally, Luz, review for our listeners the district's D's of mosquito prevention.
Yes. So as you know, as we kind of go into the spring and summer season when mosquitoes are going to be active, please remember to, first of all, drain any stagnant water at least once a week. Look around your yard, drain all that stagnant water. You know, dress in protective clothing, either long sleeves, pants, or defend yourself with some mosquito repellent if you're going to be spending time outdoors. You know, close those doors, fix any holes that might be in your windows to prevent mosquitoes from going in your house where they can bite. And then lastly, please give the district a call. If you do see a lot of mosquitoes around your area, we're here to help. You know, we can come out and provide a free service inspection, provide recommendations, bring you fish. We also have mosquito repellent wipes available for, you know, for agencies that serve the homeless or for parks and rec, for golf areas, you know, your Boy Scout troops that are going on camping trips over the summer. Please give us a call. We have lots of free services to help you out.
Luz, nice seeing you.
Nice to see you too. Thank you.
Luz Robles is the public information officer with the Sacramento Yellow Vector Control District, talking to us about this year's mosquito season. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The rain and snowfall that hit California in the last 4 months will continue to challenge emergency services across the Central Valley. The record snowpack in the southern Sierra Nevada will begin to melt, with many farm communities ill-prepared for the potential flooding that is projected. The slow-moving disaster will challenge man-made levees and canals in the San Joaquin Valley and will inevitably cause some damage to the region, and that includes schools. According to EdSource, one out of five California schools are in areas of high or moderate flood risk, including many throughout the Central Valley. Helping to break down which schools are at risk and what's being done to reduce or even prevent damage to schools is EdSource investigative reporter Thomas Peel and EdSource equity reporter Emma Gallegos. Good morning. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
Emma, I want to start with you. You grew up in the Central Valley in Bakersfield. How was this winter season for you? Have you ever seen the amount of heavy rainfall that has affected that portion of the Central Valley before?
I can't remember the last time it was like this. I think 97, 98, that El Nino year is the one that came closest, but this is one for the record books.
When did you both start looking into this reporting and this investigation?
When the Tulare County started to get hit and Tule Lake began to fill, and there were a couple of poor communities down there that got washed out. I thought it was time to start looking at the FEMA data and determining how many schools in California were at flood risk.
Yeah, you bring up a really important point, because we've had conversations on Insight about the reemergence of Tulare Lake, the risks that are just associated with the basin and connected to other flood risks across the San Joaquin Valley. I mean, we know that these aren't isolated, right? I mean, and this is such a large region of California. Is there a general consensus, before we get into the specifics of school districts or certain areas that are more at risk than others, is there a general consensus that there will be some flooding damage that will happen in the coming weeks and months impacting schools, Thomas?
The consensus is yes, and it's more than some. It's inevitable. There's record snowpack in the Sierra, as we all know. And as one expert put it to us, it's like there's a cannon up there filled with water ready that's going to start firing when the snow melts. And the numbers, based on the amount of snow, clearly indicate that the rivers are going to be overwhelmed.
What metrics determine flood risk for schools?
Well, it depends where schools are built. And schools are often not built in the best places in communities. When you have more than 1,000 school districts in the state, many of them small, many of them rural, they often struggle to find the right land to build schools. They have to take donated land. They might not have the bonding capacity to buy the best land available. So many schools find themselves in low-lying areas where housing has not been built. That happened earlier this year to a school district in Merced County that was overwhelmed when a levee breached. So there are, as we reported, roughly 1 in 5 schools in California is at high or moderate flood risk, according to the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Mm-hmm. And that creates a host of problems, especially for small districts.
Emma, given that you're a journalist in the Central Valley and you grew up in Bakersfield, what do you want people to understand about the schools and school districts that are located in this portion of the state?
Yeah, I think it's important for people to understand, when we think of earthquakes, there's a lot of standards for schools to be built in a certain way, because schools are kind of like the community centers, particularly in a lot of these small towns. So when a disaster happens, you want that school to be safe and standing so that people can go there and get food and water. And we've even seen in Alpaw Unified, which is near the Tulare Lake area, there was a lot of flooding, and the school was closed because the town was evacuated, but a lot of people were still going to the school to get their daily meals. So, schools do play an important role, particularly in these like small rural communities.
Yeah, talked to that community in Alpaw, but there's also the Fireball Las Deltas Unified School District. And I believe there, 6 of the 7 schools are at high risk flood territory. When you're talking to school district officials or school staff, what are they telling you about the concern of what's projected to come?
Yeah, I mean, they're very concerned. They're trying to do the best that they can with the resources they have. They don't feel as well prepared as they could be. So, I went to Fireball, which is a community in Fresno County, and they're right on the San Joaquin River, which is projected to have quite a bit of water coming into it. And Fireball's schools, just like the rest of the community, are right along the river. And you know, the levees are really weak in this area. So there's, you know, there hasn't been enough investment to, you know, to help both the schools and the rest of the town. And the schools, you know, when I talked to them, they were really starting to be well prepared for the idea of having to evacuate their schools and even evacuate their whole towns. I mean, in Firebaugh, the school district has all the buses in the region. You know, this is a small town. So the school is going to be who people turn to when things go bad. And yeah, so, you know, they've worked a lot on that. But Thomas and I, we've been talking to a lot of schools, and we found a lot of them find out that they don't have flood insurance. And so kind of planning for that next piece is something that the state hasn't really done a whole lot on this front, and schools are trying to figure that out as we speak.
Okay, so what goes into that? Why isn't there flood insurance, given that, I mean, this area is prone to flooding? This isn't the only wet year we've been through. There's 1997, there was even 2017 recently. I mean, what lessons were learned, and were any improvements made? Thomas?
Well, you know, flood insurance is a district by district decision, and it is not, there is no direct mandate that any school district have flood insurance. Sometimes small districts get together and form joint powers authority, which gives them more buying power. But this is an economic issue. Some districts self-insure, which means they take it on the chin when they have a problem. And it's, you know, it's all over the place. For instance, there was some flooding earlier this year in January in the Planeta Elementary School District in Merced County. It was the second time in 5 years that they'd endured a 100-year flood in a school that was built below grade. Hmm. When they had that flooding in 2018, they got relief from FEMA, and they got flood insurance that covered them for the flood earlier this year. There was a small district in Alameda County, not a place where we think of as a, you know, major flood area, that was very washed out in flooding around the first of the year. It was the Snow Glen district, a one school elementary school district. The superintendent didn't even know the district didn't have flood insurance because it was never an issue. And this was a district that was in a low risk area, according to FEMA. Hmm. But they had a stream near the school, and it became overwhelmed with rainwater. So in a changing climate and a changing environment, it's not just the districts that are at higher moderate risk that have potential problems now.
Yeah, and we don't even need to go that far back to understand that. I mean, you're talking about something that just happened a couple months ago. I mean, even in Monterey mm-hmm. County, in the community of Pajaro, there was massive flooding there. Classrooms were submerged. What are we learning about the toll and the impact that this ultimately has on education?
Well, I mean, when this happens, a building can be offline for a long time. In Pajaro, I was down there when State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurman visited that school a couple of weeks after the flooding. And they had flood insurance. They were in a floodplain. They were near a levee. They made the good judgment of having flood insurance. The insurance adjusters hadn't been there yet. It had been weeks. Mold was now setting in. They were not allowed to do any cleanup until the adjusters could come in and make their estimates based on the damage. So they were in this holding pattern, and the water was gone, but the damage was there. And there was, you know, then they faced the additional cost and cleanup of mold. So it's, you know, it's a bad problem when it happens. There's no easy fix to a, as anybody that's had their home flooded knows, there's no easy fix to water damage.
And I understand that there's individual school districts in the state, but ultimately there is the California Department of Education. I mean, when we're talking about the flooding that is projected to come, I mean, we've had the Office of Emergency Services on talking about specifically the Tulare Basin. You know, we know what's going to happen in the next coming weeks and months? I mean, what role does the Department of Education in our state have to prepare schools and try to mitigate any damage?
They will help with damage. They are pretty good at helping get modular classrooms in the areas that have flooding. But, you know, this year there's also been, we've had this weather, these atmospheric rivers, and there's been not just the flooding risk of what's going to happen in the spring when the rivers are overwhelmed. There has been the daily issue that the Department of Education, with its limited facilities, resource people, have to deal with, which is when schools are snowed out, when there's massive rain that might not threaten to flood a building, but limits the transportation for people to get to school. So they've had to deal with the bad winter, just like the rest of California has. You know, there's a school at about 7,000 feet in Alpine County that had so much snow on the roof, they had to evacuate the building. And the Department of Education has been helping that school in Bear Valley find an alternative place to have classes. So they've been, you know, overwhelmed by the weather and concentrating on that on a daily basis a little bit more than they've been, you know, planning for May in the Tulare Basin.
You know, Thomas, I mean, you're talking about an area that is, I mean, we're going from the Bay Area in Alameda County to the Central Valley to Monterey County along the coast. And now you're talking to us at about Alpine County in the Sierra Nevada. So it really looks like pretty much it touches every corner of the state. What is your big takeaway?
The big takeaway is that we all know that the environment and the climate is changing. And there's going to be tough decisions for schools to make. And a lot of it comes down to money. There are schools that are built in floodplains that maybe should be moved. Maybe the school shouldn't be there. Maybe it should be elevated. But we're dealing often with one school districts or districts with just a couple of schools, elementary school districts, not a lot of bonding capacity, not a lot of resources and the ability to go build a new school on higher ground. So there's going to be tough decisions as the climate continues to change about the location of schools.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with EdSource reporters about the flood risk for schools in the Central Valley due to melting snowpack. Okay, Emma, we know that schools are so much more than just education. I mean, they provide food. They're a part of the community. When it comes to the Central Valley and when you're disrupting education, you know, to this level due to climate change and due to natural disasters, you know, what is the long-term impact and consequence? Because there are many communities in the Central Valley, incredibly diverse, also low income, and there's barriers, including language.
Yeah, absolutely. We should note that a lot of these schools that have been affected this year, they're in a lot of areas that are, they have high levels of poverty. A lot of these are areas where a lot of farm workers live. I'm thinking of Planada, I'm thinking of Pajaro, thinking of Alpa and Allensworth. And so these are communities that are already struggling on a day-to-day basis. These are not easy questions. We did talk to some experts. I'm thinking of Jeffrey Vincent at UC Berkeley, who said that, you know, the state could step up and try to encourage some of these districts to get flood insurance and be better prepared. I was actually surprised when I went to Firebaugh, because this is the place that they have experienced some flooding in the past. They're right on the river. And I was surprised at how ill prepared the school was previously. So the superintendent in the district, I know they're working really hard right now, but I was surprised that the state hadn't stepped in and, you know, mandated some kind of flood insurance or mandated a stronger flood emergency plan. I think there is a role for the state to do more. Whether or not that will happen, we will see. But these are communities that are already, you know, really marginalized and don't have a lot of money and resources to begin with. So it'll be tough.
When it comes to that money and those resources, I mean, at the beginning of our conversation, Thomas, you mentioned that the infrastructure, the water infrastructure, isn't as strong as it could be. I mean, there are thousands of miles of levees across the state. I mean, even the Sacramento Valley is considered a flood risk area. However, the levees and flood mitigation in the Sacramento area seems to be a well-organized system. How does that compare to the water infrastructure and flood protection in the Central Valley?
You're correct, Vicki, that the Sacramento area is better prepared than the Central Valley for, you know, the inevitable floods that California is going to face this year. I mean, in the lower Central Valley, in the Tulare region, you know, in the end, it's a question of whether nature is going to win. I mean, Tulare Lake was huge. It was the biggest lake in the United States west of Salt Lake. And the agricultural industry wanted that bottomland. And the lake was drained, and it took it. And there's, you know, anybody who's familiar with the writings of the great journalist Mark Arax knows there's a river down there that was engineered to flow backwards, and that levees are, and canals are all over the place. And it's agriculture first, flood safety somewhere behind that. We're also coming off these years of drought. And no one seems to worry that much about levees when there's not much water behind them. Mm-hmm. And as one levee expert told me, droughts are bad for levees because they dry out. They become more brittle in the heat. And that's, you know, clearly what happened in Merced County in January. So, you know, the ground zero for this really is going to be the Tulare Basin. And it's not as prepared perhaps as it should be. There are more than 30 schools in Tulare County itself that are at high flood risk. There's a majority of the schools in Visalia that are at high flood risk. And the and frankly, the response we got from the Visalia Unified School District wouldn't create a lot of confidence that they are highly prepared for this.
Emma, I want to end with you. What do you hope listeners take away from this conversation and the work that you and Thomas did?
I think that people should know, you know, one thing I'd love to direct your listeners to our site. We have this fantastic map that shows flood risk all throughout the state. You can use that whether you're interested in schools or not. But I think it's important for everyone to be educated about the flood risk that we face, especially in a year like this. But I'm sure this won't be the final year that we have something like this if we're having 100-year floods just, you know, within 5 years. For everyone to check out what is their flood risk, what is their flood risk for their local schools. And also, I think just thinking about what the state can do on a broader level to address some of these issues, because they're not going to go away.
Emma and Thomas, thanks for the time.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you for the work. Emma Gallegos is an equity reporter at EdSource, and Thomas Peel is an investigative reporter also at EdSource. And they're sharing their reporting, which found 1 out of 5 California schools are in areas of high to moderate flood risk. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, searching for one's authentic self can be a lifetime pursuit. Because let's face it, there are plenty of opportunities to get distracted from what truly gets us up in the morning and makes us tick with all of life's pressures and expectations. But our next guest used this journey as inspiration, creating a series of six plays titled With Voices, and you can experience Voices this weekend. That playwright is Victoria Goldblatt, and she joins us to discuss Voices, six plays in search of one's authentic self, with final dates this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Howe Avenue Theater in Sacramento. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning, Vicky. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
It really is a treat. You have been working on this for 10 years, am I correct?
Yes, may I add a lifetime, probably.
What sparked this journey into Voices, which culminated, it's essentially six plays. What sparked it, you know, more than a decade ago?
Well, it wasn't conscious 10 years ago. I've been fortunate enough to be involved in a writer's group, and every week we meet and there's a prompt, and the prompt was doubt. So I thought I would try writing just simply dialogue that evening, because I'm also in the Playwrights Collaborative and workshop plays. So I got this piece and the feedback was great, and I entered it into a competition and I won two of the awards out of three in the play I Doubt It, and that spurred me on to really, I realized I love plays. I love writing about dialogue. So since then, I've written five other plays, and four. And I just felt that through the last 10 years, being with friends and observing people, that we all have a voice, even if we're young, from a little person in kindergarten to all the way up as we get older. People want to connect through sharing their feelings and joys and sorrows. So I thought, why don't I put something together that will encapsulate all ages, all levels, all nationalities, in terms of there is really no separation. And I wanted to portray that through this media of art.
Yeah, I mean, the six plays that people take in, it really spans generations, which mm-hmm. is just wonderful. And it just shows we're all connected and we share a lot more in common than we may share in differences. When it comes to your background, you have a lengthy background in the art scene here in Sacramento.
Yeah, I try to keep myself busy. That's true. I've been in some community theater, films, been involved in Playwrights Collaborative, workshopping new plays, and now playing, trying my hand as a playwright. So I'm just trying to, explore life and get involved as much as possible.
You know, now that you've gone from the page to the stage, you had your first performances last week. What was the reaction that you had from the audience?
Well, you know, that, I'm still reeling from the phenomenal feedback we've gotten. Standing ovations every night. Sunday, we sold 45 tickets and we had 25 walk-ins, because word of mouth, people are hearing about it. I've come home on a Sunday and I'm getting texts and emails from people I don't really know. Of course, my friends have been very supportive and have given me nice feedback, but I'm getting many, many comments from people that heard about the play from word of mouth and are thanking their friends for inviting them. So it's been overwhelming and exciting, and it's been amazing, to tell you the truth.
Do you think that there was one play out of the six that resonated with people more than others, or perhaps one that resonates with you more?
Well, you know, that's I've been asking people about that. And what's amazing is everybody has one play that they feel is, you know, stood out for them. And I think when we see a play, we take our own essence and values of life and we project that onto something we resonate with. I've had people from the one called Holes in the Ceiling is about a young girl who is being bullied, and she locks herself into the girls' bathroom because she doesn't want to come out anymore to go back to class. She was bullied for being Jewish, and so from anybody who's been bullied, regardless of what the issue is or what they're being bullied for, will resonate with that piece. However, we have people from the Jewish community that came up to me after the show and really moved them. So I think, and that everybody, you know, tags on to something that they relate to. I had one friend of mine who loved The Star, which is a wonderful little actress who's 9 years old, and she plays myself when I was a latchkey kid. And so I came home to an empty house to ward off the loneliness, and I just had my dog Gidget. So before my mother came home, I pretended I was famous and a star. And this delightful gal actor, Zoe Schroeder, she is phenomenal. And one of my friends said that that was her favorite. So, and then the other one, Remembering Pi, is based on the work that I did. I'm an exercise specialist, and I've worked in assisted and independent living and memory care, and I wrote the play based on some of the people that came to my class that were residents of the memory care facility. And I wanted to give people with Alzheimer's a voice. So this character, Remembering Pi, is based on three characters that, three residents that I consolidated to give a voice behind the scenes of people who are living in a facility to understand what their life is like. Everybody needs a voice. And so I've had people that who have loved ones in memory care facility really were moved by that piece.
Yeah,
so in answer to your question, I think it's just everybody likes different parts, different plays based on their experience.
Yeah, I mean, you take on some really powerful themes from anti-Semitism to, you know, loneliness as a child and memory issues as well, like Alzheimer's. How did this playwriting journey over the past decade or so really deepen your own understanding of what authenticity is?
I'll tell you the truth. The journey is, first off, it's my very first opportunity to be a producer. As an actor, we get a part, we play, we memorize it, we go on stage, and the audience is there. As a producer, I'm doing everything, getting the audience and hiring the actors and everything. So the journey in terms of authenticity is, how do I find my voice to inspire my actors and my dream team, a phenomenal behind-the-scenes people that have been helping, getting the tickets and everything. How do I find my voice and being authentic, keeping it light, in the same time trying to be cool about it and keeping everybody together? So I think being authentic is an everyday process, from going to the store to being authentic and being kind to people when you're grocery shopping. It's a moment-to-moment choice, I believe.
What inspiration do you hope people take away?
I really want to encourage people to laugh. Goldie is the last play, and she's based on my aunt Florence, who is from the Bronx and had her own business with her husband, and she's very authentic. It's also based on my parents, who fell in love dancing, and they were ballroom dancers, and so Goldie incorporates dance, and the whole play is about laughter and making fun of herself and life. So I want people to take away the balance of laughter and joy and sorrow that comes with being a part of this life. And I want to encourage people to speak up and be themselves. And I think the reason why I decided at this point to put this show together is it's time. It's time for me to share my story. It's time. It's everybody's story. It's not okay to be bullied. It's not okay to put people away in memory care facility without knowing at one time they had their voice. And we need to acknowledge everybody from the child all the way up to the senior. We all need to speak up. And I think that's the essence of what I want people to walk away with.
Victoria, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Vicki. I really appreciate it today.
Victoria Goldblatt is a playwright discussing her new play titled Voices, Six Plays in Search of One's Authentic Self. Final air dates are this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Howe Avenue Theater in Sacramento. We have more information on our Insight page. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Tuesday. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.